Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Channel. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we're going to be talking about magic weapons in D&D, particularly intelligent weapons like intelligent swords, or possibly other mega world-beating magic weapons like infinity gauntlets and stuff like that.
There you go. You know, honestly, I think as I think back in my history of playing D&D, I don't think I really used intelligent weapons when I was younger. I think it wasn't really until fairly recently and digging back into old school stuff that I thought, you know what, intelligent weapons feel like such a trope that I need to play into it.
That's a really good point, and I would agree the same for me, and they slightly get de-emphasized in later editions. They become rarer and rarer in later editions, so if you did step into it with, if you got started with BX or AD&D, it's not something that's going to be in your face all the time. And then when you step back, as I've also been doing in recent years and digging into original D&D, boy, they are really in your face. You cannot cannot avoid the special intelligent swords.
You just mean with the I assume you're talking about the frequency they show up on the treasure charts.
Yeah. Yeah. Specifically what, you know, whether your sword is intelligent or not.
You know, I guess an interesting point there that I noticed just looking at like the raw treasure charts in OD&D is that I feel like there wasn't a lot of variation besides intelligent weapons, right? You had like +1 or +2 or +3 weapons and then your intelligent weapons and not very many other things. And I feel like later editions of D&D, they really started adding in specific magic weapons with weird different powers.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the other thing, it seems now rather obvious that you could have a more mix and match table, right? So like you have a miscellaneous weapons table where you've got a spear +1 or a spear +2, and that's it for spears. There's nothing else that spear can possibly do except that. And then you have this separate sword table that does have +1 this, +2 that, +1 or +3 versus trolls specifically, right? And then maybe one charm person ability, and then maybe you go to the intelligent swords table, and now it seems kind of obvious that you could have had those extra bonuses for any weapon, or a matrix of, you know, special +1 against any monster in the book. Why not do that? But I guess when they did those original tables, they didn't think about that fully matrixed, the many dimensions that you could have had to that.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Definitely, like the way the powers are laid out for intelligent weapons in OD&D, it really becomes this mix and match. Like, roll up your crazy item. I guess why not do that for other stuff?
Exactly. Yeah, I think with like by Mentzer's companion rules, I think he did that. Is he like all those abilities start becoming applicable to any particular weapon? But up until I think Mentzer did that, it was always in the Gygaxian stuff. That stuff was always restricted just to swords. So the thing that I noticed that, and I wouldn't have been able to remember this if I hadn't been looking it up right before this. So like you look in AD&D, or I think you look in BX, you roll up a magic sword, and then you go to the table for intelligence, and you have like a 25% chance of it being intelligent. You got to roll percentile dice. Mm-hmm. It's got to come up above 75. But in original D&D, technically, if you look in the book, every single sword is intelligent.
Right. They're...
You roll up any magic sword in original D&D, and you have to go roll a d12. That's its intelligence. And, you know, if you roll below 6, you don't get any special powers out of it. But technically, every single sword in original D&D is intelligent, and no other weapon is intelligent. Hmm.
I wonder if that's very Tolkien-ish. It reminds me of Tolkien, right? Where it like, seems like every magic sword they came across had a name and a history and a, you know. Although now I'm pushing myself to try and think of, like, do they have any other magic weapons? Did they use any other weapons besides swords?
That's a good point. I mean, was...
Straight in my head.
I mean, Bilbo's weapon's technically a dagger, right? And they had that named and it lit up, right? Technically,
true,
that was a dagger.
True, but it was right? a sword to him.
Right. True. Exactly. So I think that, like, a lot... So I think most... So that's a good point. And of course, in later years, Gygax would always decline to act like Tokine had any bearing on D&D at all, which is a pretty... Which a lot of people will take at face value, but it seems like a pretty hard argument to make. And so I think a lot of people will admit that the thing that was on his mind was Elric by Michael Moorcock. I have it right here. Excellent. So Elric with his famous sword. Oh, no. What is it? Black Razor? What am I? No. That's the one S2.
I've actually never read Moorcock myself, so I can't help you.
Stormbringer, right? So Stormbringer is an intelligent entity sword that he's got that, you know, sucks everybody's soul out.
In the in the upper right corner there of that, does it say cleric? No, sorry, the left.
It's Elric, right?
Oh, is the E just?
Yeah, the E, it's kind of stylized.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a funny observation. Anyway, so there's like my collection of the good Elric stories. You can find later ones that Moorcock wrote that were prequels that were terrible, but the good ones are there. And then in turn, Moorcock himself said he basically got the idea of the cosmic intelligent world-beating sword from Paul Anderson's The Broken Sword, which came before that. Which is also highly recommended, really great, really comes a lot out of Norse myth of there's a sword, and when you draw it out, someone's going to die. And in the Moorcock stories, that Stormbringer sword's super, super powerful. It, you know, can kill gods if you hit them the right way with it. And,
you know,
50-year spoiler alert, that sword winds up destroying the whole world by the end of it.
Interestingly, I think one of the things that's missing in D&D are those sort of double-edged items, like you talked about, where you pull out the sword, it's got to kill someone. It's something I find myself adding in quite a lot. I think in our last stream, I mentioned having taken a Ring of Regeneration and turning it into an incredibly fragile twig crown, just to screw with my players. But I've done that with other stuff. I think I remember a campaign where I had a fairly powerful magical sword that could not be scabbarded. It would just slice through the scabbard if you ever tried to put it away, because it demanded to be out and like it just really wanted to kill.
Interesting.
And as I recall, let me think, is this the same sword or not? I can't remember, but I had a sword called the Hungry Bastard that required the user to eat double the amount they would normally eat when they use the sword. Like, them so hungry.
That's great. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, it's interesting. I probably don't do that enough, is the idiom in original D&D is that the sword's either great or it's horrible.
Yep.
It's either a positively powered magic sword, or it's cursed and everything about it's totally horrible.
Yeah, I love adding in those little gotchas just to make it like, well, the sword is great, but... you know, when you're walking around town and trying to talk to people and you're holding your sword out, then they're going to be like, hey, put your sword away. I'm like, I can't.
So in my campaign game, I had the players ran into both types. They actually recently got two swords. One was very good and one was very bad.
Interesting.
And so they went to the city, you know, to try to get the curse removed because it's glued to the fighter. And there was a lot of great role play around him trying to put it down and me telling him, yes, you are convinced that you've put it down, and then tell all the other players, no, he still has it. He just put it right back in his scabbard. And everybody playing. And so there's a really, really great lot of role playing between the different perceptions about whether he put it down or not.
That's excellent.
And then they went to the city to try to get the curse removed. And I myself forgot that I had a rule that at the gates of the city you have to give away into the armory all of your weapons and armor. So I've gotten used to that, And I overlooked the fact that he physically couldn't put the sword down.
Right.
And then when the city and they put and then the players bring up, well, what's the situation with the sword? And I was like, oh no. I just hand waved. Well, there was a 2-hour scene that we didn't go through of you attempting to give the sword to the guard at the gate until they just got tired of it and just said, okay, go ahead. Clearly this is not working. So that's I had to retcon that in my game.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. That'd be a fun scene to play out.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, didn't we, maybe this was just a pure curse, but I'm trying to remember at my birthday party, didn't something terrible happen to Max and you guys had to, like, go and get him decursed?
Well, he got the helmet of alignment changing.
Ah, yes.
So he was turned evil, and, I mean, you know, we knew that.
Yep. Oh, he played it really smooth, though. He was very much like, everything's fine, I just gotta go see this guy, and I'm not gonna kill him.
Yeah, I'm like, oh god, it's one of those damn helmets again.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it was Max and his friends are really just super great to play that kind of thing out with. It was really the whole combination of them trying to get the fighter to put the sword away was really really delightful about two sessions ago for me.
That's great. I think you know, if you want to work in those little gotchas for magic items that are otherwise good, I think you can do it more subtly. It doesn't have to be like, oh, you can never put it away. I think at one point I ran a thing where I gave out what was effectively a staff of healing, which is a great magic item, especially for a low-level group, because it's one cure light for everyone per day. But instead of a staff, it was a hookah. And so they had to spend 10 minutes getting it out and setting it up and putting the leaf in it and lighting it up and sitting around like it had to be you had to have a relaxing little pass the hookah around moment in order to receive the healing. And it was nice because it just meant like the actual mechanical change there is that you couldn't use it in the middle of combat.
Yeah.
Right. It needed to be a kind of a restful thing.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, when they wrote original D&D, it's a very coarse. I mean, original D&D is fairly coarse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can see why the very first thing is like, here's a good sword, here's a bad sword. And, you know, so as time goes on, making things a little bit more nuanced is great, is really what you want.
So I'm leading you up here to what I've done with intelligent weapons, or intelligent swords particularly. So I can't think of a campaign where I ever gave a player an intelligent sword, but I think by the time I was running a lot of convention games, I started, I think I saw you do this, and I thought, oh, that's great, where you sort of created a batch of characters that you just reuse across multiple adventures. And I thought, that's great, I'll get used to those characters, I'll be able to refine them and test them and do stuff. So I made a batch of about 16 characters that I bring to pretty much, and I have them at different levels. I have them at level 4 and level 8 and level whatever. So in this batch of characters, two of them ended up with intelligent swords, because I just rolled. And they ended up with intelligent swords. And so I gave them names and personalities and whatnot, and they basically became these recurring NPCs for me to play every time I use this batch of characters, which is super fun.
Yeah.
And they're very diametrically opposed. They're basically, I have a halfling warrior who has a sword named Pip, who speaks in a quiet kind of English voice and tries to be very helpful. And I have a human thief who has got a very Arabian tilt to his name. I think his name is something like Majid of the Seven Wonders or something like that. Something great.
Right.
He has all kinds of weird magic items, including Aisha the Vexing. And Aisha the Vexing is a sword who really just wants to wreck stuff and gets very angry. And is constantly bickering. She just likes to bicker. Like, she just will always be contrary just to be annoying to Majid. So role-playing those two swords is super fun. And so one of the things I did to allow myself more opportunity to play with them, because I found myself really enjoying playing those swords, is I've interpreted all of the detection abilities to be innate to the sword and not just granted to the owner. So yes, Aisha the Vexing can see invisible objects, but you have to talk to Aisha and ask her, do you see any invisible objects? And she'll tell you.
Right. And that's so in general, it's funny you say that, because I've been on the exact same path. Is my high level convention games for the last couple of years has been the test bed for me to test out how intelligent swords and their powers interact and work. And I also have never had an intelligent sword in a campaign until the last month. In the last month, my players did finally actually find an intelligent sword. So they just picked it up and they've just started to figure out how to use it.
Neat.
Particularly where they were blocked because the fighter that wanted to use it was cursed for a session. So I'm just have that in my campaign for the very first time. And I saw the characters that you're talking about when we played the game at TotalCon a month ago, and boy, that really worked stupendously with you role playing the swords and the players having to interact with that. I think that worked.
It was a lot of fun, especially because there was a lot of, I think I had both detect invisible and detect traps on the swords.
Right.
And there was a lot of that.
which were incredibly critical for that game. So trying to figure out the right information from the Aisha sword was actually a really critical point in that game.
It was. I think I had a great moment where somebody invoked the detect traps on Aisha, and she said, "You're standing right on top of it, you fool."
So here's a question: like in original D&D, the majority. Okay, so you roll a d12 for intelligence on your sword, right? And if you roll 1 through 6, that basically becomes academic because they don't have any special powers and they can't communicate. Mm-hmm. And then the values, the intelligence values like 7, 8, 9, 10 all say they communicate by empathy. And then the only ones that actually talk on that table are like if you roll an 11 or 12 on D12.
Interesting.
So I noticed with both of the intelligence swords in your games, talking to the player, was that like a thing that you house ruled, or was that you?
Isn't there a step? Is there not a step between speaks out loud and empathy, where it's more of a telepathic communication? Am I misremembering that? I don't have.
No, that's the top level one. So I'll just get my book here. Top level one actually is the telepathy.
I mean, either. Either I misread it or I intentionally.
So the very last one is telepathy.
Oh, yeah. Sure enough.
Yeah, so 7, 8, 9 are all empathy, 10, 11 are speech, and then 12 is telepathy.
I mean, empathy's tough. How would you rule that if not talking directly to the player?
Yeah, I think AD&D has slightly more detail. I mean, I've been going in the direction of like you feel a throb in a particular direction kind of thing.
And it's weird too to me that telepathy is somehow the more powerful or better one. I would want to invert that. I would want to invert that because I think a sword that can actually speak out loud, that is much easier to deal with, I think, at social levels, right? Because like this sword's talking. Clearly it's magical. It's a talking sword, right? It's a talking dog. Right. Everyone knows that the dog is magic.
Right.
Whereas my halfling fighter, who happens to be named Bungo the Drunk, is going around telling you, oh, Pip said this, Pip said that. And you're going, really?
That is delightful.
How much have you had to drink today?
At no point do I want to take that away from your games, because that bit about whether or not the character actually has an intelligent sword or whether they're just hallucinating... is just pure gold. So I was wondering how you came up with that, because however you came up with that, that was the right decision.
Yeah, I think I honestly don't know at this point if it was that I just misread the chart or that I read the chart and went, that's dumb, and just changed it. I can't tell you.
Right.
I can tell you right now that I want to change it because I don't like what's in that chart.
Great. I mean the chart has been changed a lot, right? So when you move to AD&D, the chart's a lot different.
Right. Right.
So I mean, everybody,
you're kind of ruining the fun of an intelligent sword, I think, if it can't communicate in any way, right? Well, is it really intelligent if it can't communicate? Can't communicate and it can't act on its own. Define intelligence, I guess.
Well, again, in Michael Moorcock, it's an alien intelligence.
All right.
It's an alien entity that you can't communicate with properly. It's an alien.
Okay.
I tell you.
So you think that's where the empathy stuff comes from?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, probably so.
That makes sense. I would jump to telepathy. I might, in fact, rewrite the... I might tune that a little bit to, in fact, add a sort of telepathy only through physical contact, right? Yeah. So it can only communicate telepathically with you if you actually have it on you or holding it or whatnot. I think I do remember, now I do have actually a third character in that group that I have that just has a sword that has the ability to locate objects, but is not intelligent. Because I think that's on the chart, right? That's a sword with locate object, not intelligent.
Yes, some that's on some sword chart somewhere, yes. Absolutely.
So the way I always interpreted that is basically you have the Inigo Montoya ability of, you know, show me where the door is, and he just holds out the sword and it pulls. The sword literally pulls. It acts like a like a compass or a magnet or something like that.
Right, which is great. Just as I'm thinking about it right now, I think part of the, like, with the speech results in that table, you're supposed to go roll, between 1 and 4, you know, monster languages. So the speech is giving you the capacity to communicate with a couple monsters.
Okay.
And then the telepathy result is giving you the ability to communicate with any monster.
Gotcha. Interesting.
I think is how I'm reading that.
I think direct telepathic link to only the wielder is about the most fun entry I can think of. So maybe that's how I am interpreting empathy.
There you go. Perfect. That's it. Those were the words I was also trying to say.
Awesome. So how have you used, I guess, let me start with this, because obviously maybe your players are watching and maybe you don't want to say. What powers in your game do the players know about the intelligence sword having?
Okay. Well, I'll say, they haven't figured it out yet. Actually.
They don't know at all.
They basically don't. They've tried a couple things and they actually don't, which is interesting at the moment. So I'll say this. The basic powers table is almost all detection stuff.
It is. You know what? I think that's what pushes me even more into wanting to be able to communicate with the thing, because all its abilities are the ability to detect stuff.
Right. So there's detect alignment, detect secret doors, detect traps, detect gems, detect, you know, coin treasures, and on and on and on. So when they step into your game, consider whether you're happy about that possibly overruling, like, maybe some thief skills, or if you have a cleric with detect traps, like all of a sudden that might become the go-to detection thing for that. Or you know, elves with special secret door capacity. Well, once a sword with detect secret doors comes in your game, all of a sudden that's automatic and none of that other stuff matters anymore.
Yep.
So consider whether you're happy about that. The other thing is that, as usual in OD&D, the power level is kind of uncorked. Is it doesn't have any limitation for how often you use it. In AD&D, it explicitly says all those basic detection powers are at will as many times as you want.
Yep.
So once detect secret doors comes in on a sword, expect your players to be detecting secret doors all the time, because there's no limitation to it and it's automatically found.
I feel like you get the same effect with Elven Cloak and Boots, right? Like, just as your thief is starting to get high enough level to actually have those abilities at a reasonable success rate, you end up with that magic item, and then, whatever, they're just always invisible and always silent, so.
And same for climbing walls versus, like, boots of levitation.
Yep. Agreed.
I agree. So you want to think about that in advance. And then back to your question, Paul, about what do my players know. So my players have played in a couple of my high-level convention games.
Mm-hmm.
So they've learned, you know, what the possible scope is of the intelligence swords. And I'll say that our friend Lauren, that came to HelgaCon for the first time ever and got to see that high-level play for the first time, she came away, and one of the things she specifically said is, we need to get our fight in our campaign. We need to get our fighters some intelligence swords so the fighters can cast spells. What's her take on it, right? Which is that's the kind of thing I like to see from a new player, because that's a perspective I wouldn't have brought to it. But in her current observation, that's how fighters get spells, is with the intelligent swords.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
I guess it's kind of true.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's interesting.
Likewise, I would say potions. Right, I love giving fighters like potions of fly or stuff like that. Invisibility.
Right. And so, you know, some analysts say that's one of the major, the fact that all those powers are only on swords makes that a really important feature of fighters in original D&D. Only fighters can use swords. The wizards can't. The clerics can't.
Yep.
And the fact that unlocks all those intelligent sword powers only for fighters is a major class ability. And some people would say if you do take those powers, put them on other weapons, all of a sudden that degrades fighters as a result.
That's a really interesting point. I could totally see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually don't...
So anyway, my players have been... knowing that the powers are detection, my players are trying to detect all those different things.
Great. Good for them.
With the sport. It's currently where we are.
Good for them. I was just going to say... Sorry?
Yep. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I kind of don't mind more things that make swords better. Like, I think even at the base level, there's some stuff where, like, sword just does a little more damage than pretty much most other one-handed weapons. And I kind of like that reflects the reality of how many people carried swords in the Middle Ages, right? It was the preferred weapon for good reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And they're also a little bit lighter in the rules. Mm-hmm. If you look at the encumbrance, and then in my games, I also have them be the only weapon that you can pull out and attack with in the same round.
Yep, because they're in a sheath. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to untie some kind of knot or string your bow or something like that, so...
Now, I seem to recall something that's come up year after year in your outdoor spoliation game is that one of those swords has a wish. Is that
yeah.
an intelligent sword?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Excellent. So, is it?
Have you?
Yeah.
And I'm curious, have you brought its intelligence at all to bear in the wish-granting part of things?
I have not. To be perfectly honest, the wish has basically been how you get one character back every year.
Right.
Perfectly frank. So I've been pretty generous with that. That sword got destroyed this year.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, that sword actually just got destroyed this year. So they were battling multiple giant black puddings, and that character thrust the sword in the black pudding, and it failed its save.
Oh, no.
So they lost. Yeah.
And yeah, I assume that means you'll carry that forward. That sword no longer exists.
That is correct. That was the end of the get a character back free every session, as a matter of fact.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Now you can have swords with wishes and not be intelligent.
Yep.
That one happened to be both.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. That one happened to be both. So I can see why you're asking that. I can certainly see you playing an intelligent sword whereby you have to get the sword's permission to use the wish in a particular way. In that game, I wanted people to get back quickly into the game, so I was being pretty loose
right,
with that.
Right, yeah, it is definitely a little different in a convention versus in campaign.
Right.
I guess I'm kind of eager to see using an intelligent sword in a campaign just because I've never done it.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would really warp the game.
Yeah, I've put some... I'll say that at the moment I put some thought into what powers I wanted to see played with initially.
Yep.
And then maybe later on I would, you know, move to some other powers to see what would happen.
So, powers aside, that's the one other factor of intelligent swords that we haven't talked about is their ability to take over.
Right. So there's the control rule, and it's different in original D&D and AD&D. And so Paul, when I go to my convention games, I have little notes about under what circumstances that could come into play. How often has that come up for you in your convention games?
In my convention games, it's far more often a threat than anything else.
Yeah.
I make sure that the players know it exists, and I tell them what's likely to trigger it. Now I statted things out intentionally, because I kind of handcrafted those intelligent swords a little bit, just so that... just based on playing them in convention after convention and not wanting them to completely upend the convention game.
Right.
Such that, basically, at full health and ready to go, the players are always going to win those contested will rolls. And so it's not until they've taken damage that they're actually in danger of being taken over. Now, that's happened once or twice in my convention game where...
Yeah.
And I just have some very specific behaviors that the two swords will try to partake in, right? Aisha, the Vexing, super wants to just kill stuff and just get in the thick of it. And to the point of, like, well, if I get beaten, that's fine because the better warrior will now wield me, right? that's Aisha's attitude.
Great.
And then
Darwin
is generally much, much more conservative to the point of almost being cowardly.
Okay.
And we'll just try to, like, let's get out of here.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is a really great contrast. The point right at the beginning about you told the players what could potentially happen at the start. I never do that.
No. Oh, it's
no. I have an index. I have an index card on my side of the screen, and if that happens, it's a total surprise.
That's funny. I have it right on the character sheet. I have all the numbers right on the character sheet. That says,
okay.
Here's your score. Here's the sword score. Here's how you make the roll.
Interesting.
Let me qualify that. That's the way I've been slowly leading over time. Okay. I've been putting more and more onto the character sheet. I think what I don't have and what I do want, now that I'm saying it out loud, is specifically just absolute instructions. Here's how to make the roll when I ask you to make the roll. Roll this, add this number, compare to that. Tell me.
Okay.
Honestly, it's always, even though I did write a blog post a while back where I did some analysis on the numbers and then tried to boil it down as to as simple a rule as I possibly can, the fact is it comes up so infrequently that I never remember it on the spot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah. And I've been having the same problem.
Yeah. So I got it down to like, what is it? A D20 plus two modifiers greater than or equal to 20. It's really straightforward. But again, I never remember it. And then by the time it comes up, I'm like, oh crap, where did I write that down? Flip, flip, flip. Let me find it.
Right.
And I'm realizing like the right place to put it is just right on their character sheet.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I have the sword stats on the character sheet. I have, for what it's worth, original D&D actually says you should have a special index card just for an intelligent sword.
Yeah, like, that's a good idea.
Every intelligent sword should sort of have its own character sheet in the form of an index card, is what it actually says. So my character sheets have the sword's name, the intelligence, the ego, and the player probably has no idea what any of that means. And then my plan is that I'm going to spring it on them by surprise. And that's happened at least once in the past for our friend BJ. So I said, okay, at this point you're injured and you better make this roll. And now you're going to charge into combat whether you want to or not. And BJ was like, I do the what with the what?
Yeah.
Who the what?
So here's now I'm going to double down on what I just said. Here's how you make it super fun for that player. You hand them the card and say, now you play this character. Right? I mean, because I think we've seen that, and we've seen that with BJ in particular, where he's been in a situation where his character's being controlled and he kind of rebels against it. Whereas I think the way to get them to buy in is to say, no, you can still get to play, just you're playing a different character, here it is.
Okay.
Please roleplay this character.
Okay.
I think that'd be super fun.
That's great. That's great. all right, I got to recover from that, because, man, that was awesome. Okay, so let's talk about the control rules.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Original D&D, as you would expect, super freaking complicated, right?
Yep.
So there's this, you take the player's strength and intelligence sum, and you take the sword's intelligence and ego sum, and then depending on, then there's three categories of health, whereby you're either, the character's either full strength or half strength or low strength. Each of those categories, you get to roll a die for how many power points is lost. And then after that, you get to take the difference between the player and the sword. And then you get to look that up on a new table. And the new table tells you the percentage chance that the player is in control or the other person's in control in stressful circumstances. Okay, I think I more or less got that. So in play, that is so many steps.
It's ridiculous.
And it's freaking ridiculous. So once again, like, I'm getting ready for our HelgaCon convention, and 2 days in advance, I realize that I've actually added more intelligence swords to the mix, and I'm like, I'm trying to make my notes, how am I going to keep track of the freaking control rules of all these swords? It's a huge pain in the butt. And I remember that fortunately, Paul here has done an analysis maybe about 2 years ago, and that's what I'm thinking.
Looks like I posted it in January of 18. Here, I'm gonna bear with me, guys. I'm gonna try and get these charts up, and you're gonna briefly see an image from whenever the last time we used this feature was. Yep, that's not what I want at all. Let's get. So I made some charts. Basically, what I did is, I wanted to do a sort of deeper analysis of, what is the actual probability taken into the fact that you have to add all these numbers and make all these rolls and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see I made these two charts based on, like, are you heavily wounded or are you lightly wounded? Because you're right, it gets it into these categories. And so eventually I boiled it down to these two charts. And you can see that, like, basically, they look kind of the same. right? Sure, one is a little more linear and one is a little more curved, but the probability is near identical. It's just kind of shifted the curve to the left by a factor of five or so.
Yep, just basically a linear transformation there.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway, so after doing all that, I then tried to figure out, well, how can I boil down these numbers to generate the same kind of curve, but with much less rolling and table lookup and whatnot. One of the things I did is, it always talks about like, oh, add your strength and your intelligence, and then also the sword has intelligence and ego and blah, blah, blah. And I said, let's make up a stat. Let's just give it a name. So I called it the will modifier. And I said, that's your intelligence and strength, and add those together. And then the sword has a modifier, and it's intelligence and ego. Let's just add those together and write that on the character sheet so we don't have to do that addition ever again. And then I think I basically did a 5-point shift on the roll based on how wounded you are. So if you're at full hit points, you get plus 15 to the roll. And if you're at half or more hit points, you get plus 10. And if you're less than half, you get plus 5. My final thing was roll d20, add your will modifier, which again was the sum of your intelligence and ego, and add that wound modifier, which is either 5, 10, or 15. And if you get greater than or equal to 20, you retain control.
That's a good rule.
Sorry. The will modifier is both those numbers. I forgot the sword's values in there. So it's your strength and intelligence added together minus the sword's intelligence and ego. That gives you one final modifier value.
Yeah. And so when you when you posted that January of 2018, I didn't dig into your spreadsheet to confirm all that. Right before our last convention, I did that, and I'm like, I am 100% convinced. And that is my new rule. That is exactly what should have happened there. I didn't realize how incredibly linear those probabilities were actually until he did that. And that kind of thing really totally argues for that should have just been a single die roll with a single modifier.
I cannot tell you why they made it so complex. Like it's so weird. Like all these stats on you and stats on the sword and a lookup table here and another lookup table there and how wounded are you and. Wow.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like there was a day where someone was writing, and I think some people say that kind of looks like what's in Dave Arneson's first fantasy campaign document. And so, you know, someone was having a good time writing rules and wrote a bunch of rules. And I have really hard time imagining that either Gygax or Arneson sat at a table and actually did any of that. Like, you're going to. That's one of those things where by later on they would say, oh, you'd have to be an idiot to play with those rules. Obviously, no one's going to do that. So thank you for putting it in the book for the rest of us to actually have to parse.
Yeah, I guess I could imagine that maybe it's the sort of thing that could come up organically where originally it was a simple rule, but oh, shouldn't this affect it? Oh, yeah, let's add a modifier here. Oh, shouldn't that affect it? Oh, yeah, let's add a subtable there. And then you end up in this.
Good point. And never subtracting anything.
Yep.
Right. And never, as we would call it, refactor anything, just continually do stuff additive.
Right. Right. And never looking at it kind of holistically and saying like, well, what is the probability spread now for all possible values? Like, what have I done to the graph?
Right. Right. And not possibly not having computers around to make that question easily answerable.
That's a good point. That's a lot of time with a calculator and a piece of graph paper. Anyway,
right.
I'll drop a link to the blog posts where I went into it in more detail, but it's definitely what I recommend. It's very simple, and I'm gonna double down on I keep using that phrase on just stick it on the character sheet. Especially if it's a pre-gen character, you know the sword stats, you know the character stats, you might as well do all that math and just put the will modifier value there on the sheet for them. This is the number you're going to add to your D20 roll.
That's good. I mean, as a DM, I got to remember when the cases are to call for that in the first place. So I feel like I still need some kind of marker on my side of the screen to remind myself that that's even an issue when their health starts to go down. But that's fine. You should do that.
Yeah.
You know what? Paul's thought about this more closely than I have. I have scribbled his rule into my original D&D book. That's the official rule. He has, damn it. He's thought about this more than I have, so listen to what he just said.
I guess the one thing we haven't talked about is like when do you make that roll? And I'm trying to remember what the rules explicitly say on that. I generally do it when you take wounds, because maybe you've just jumped from a modifier value A to B, and that's important. And then generally very subjective rule of just high stress situation. Something dramatic has happened that maybe the sword and you disagree on. So,
yeah, I think it's a little loose for the DM's interpretation. And basically that's it. There's stressful circumstances and they have a bullet point of maybe 6 or 8 bullet points of what count as stressful circumstances. And you're right. So it does, at least the book doesn't say specifically when you take damage, but okay. So they have, so like in original D&D, there's a place that's underlined called key situations. Consult the table used for key situations above. Anyway, so that's the kind of, so if we call it stressful situations, good enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in combat, like in a horrible monster, is there treasure you could take or not? Stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's sort of like you'll know it when you see it. When it's fun.
Yeah.
How about that? When you think it would be fun, do it.
When it would be a challenge. When it would be challenging for the players. How about that?
Sure. Sure.
So one thing I got to point out is for all those complicated rules, as you said earlier, Paul, it's kind of rare that that's going to come up.
It's really rare.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you know, and the main thing is what the abilities are scaled to. Is in original D&D, the player strength and intelligence is in the range of 3 to 18, and the sword intelligence and ego are both in the range of 1 to 12. So right off the bat, just any random character probably has a will total maybe on the order of about double what the sword is. I noticed that in my convention game that I just ran, you know, one of the characters can't ever lose control. Even if their hit points are all the way down to zero, there's still no chance they're ever going to lose control. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually a relatively rare circumstance to have a character that even has the capacity to lose control, and then only when they're really, really low on hit points.
I think if you go back to those charts, actually, do I still have them there? If you go back to those charts, I guess what I'll point out is that in the heavily wounded category, which is like, this is the worst case scenario, if you assume a will difference of about 5 because, you know, because the sword is crap, generally crappier. Am I reading that right? Would it be a 5 or negative 5? I think it'd be 5.
Yeah.
That you're at about a 50-50 chance. So worst case scenario, probably not going to get worse than 50-50. And then generally, like when you get into lightly wounded and maybe you actually have a better, much better will than the sword, like it's never going to happen.
Right. Exactly. So again, it's one of those rules that's amusingly super complicated for so little good.
Yeah.
The way it's written in original D&D. If you move to AD&D, then they start adding more points to the sword based on how many powers they have and how many languages they have and whether they have an extraordinary ability and stuff like that. But none of that stuff applies in original.
I think if you wanted to play a game where the swords are more powerful and more likely to take over the characters, I think it's a pretty simple solution to just stop using D12s, right? Give them bigger numbers.
Yeah. The other thing is, the table that you came up with, right, mm-hmm. in properly, correctly interpolating what's in OD&D has the numbers are plus 15, plus 10, or plus 5. And so to my eye, another option would be to adjust those by 5. And so you'd have them be at 10, 5, and 0.
You mean the on the wound categories you're talking about?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So the bonuses that you came up with on your final table, to my eye, if those were 10, 5, 0, kind of satisfy my number sense a little bit better. And then it would be slightly more likely that the sword might take over.
Yep. Yep. I agree with that.
That would be a significant, right? That would be a legitimate change from original D&D. But when I look at those numbers, I consider whether that might not be nice or not.
Yep. Cool.
Have you ever had, so have you ever had convention or campaign game, a Stormbringer style, top level, 18 powers, like an extraordinary power, I paralyze my enemies, I get telepathy, and I might possibly end the world?
No. I mean, here's the funny thing. Dan, you've run some games like the D modules or even Outdoor Spoliation. How high level are they in Spoliation these days?
They started at 8th. Now they're at 9th.
They're at 9th.
And the GDQ characters are around 10th.
Yeah. That is generally higher level than I ever play.
Okay.
I have some versions of my characters that are levels 7 to 9. So, like, the most powerful of them have managed to make it to 9. And when I play with those characters, I'm like, whoa, what am I doing? They're so powerful.
Right.
It's just generally not a power scale that I go for, this that I'm interested in playing.
Yeah, that's fair. Many people say really the sweet spot of D&D is somewhere in the 4 to 8 category. Most of the famous classic modules are in that zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, original D&D explicitly officially says you can make the levels as high as you want. You know, the numbers will go up, but at some point they stop writing about that and it doesn't look like people were playtesting. We have an idea on the table for me in Boston this summer to run an even higher level campaign, a higher level convention game with some of our friends, specifically to put every single spell in the game on the table.
Interesting.
Specifically the idea is to run a high level wizards game where every single spell is in play,
mm-hmm.
partly as a play test for exactly that, because even with those convention characters, they still don't have 6 level spells.
Yep.
So that might be totally broken.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
But I also, in all my years, I've never had the top level intelligent sword in play.
I mean, I've certainly had terrible things happen in my game.
Right.
I mean, I had a game where a player of mine accidentally summoned the Blood God to the...
Oh, crap.
Wait, there we go. It says we've reconnected. I hope that some buffering happens there and it didn't just pop, but apologies if it popped. Little network issue there. So the question was, world-ending events. And so I've certainly had terrible, terrible things where, like, horrible demons get summoned to the world of men and are probably going to wreak havoc. But usually in those cases, it's localized. It's not like the whole world is in trouble. It's like, well, this town is not going to do so well. And the style of game I run, my player's reaction to that almost always is, time to go to a different town.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
That's very D&D. That's where we are not necessarily heroes. We are also interested in our own skins.
Yeah.
So that's very D&D.
I think that's a part of Matt Finch's old school primer that I've really internalized, where he says the power scale is, you know, unlike modern D&D, where your power scale is really quite high, he's like, the power scale is you're not, he uses a superhero analogy. He says the power scale is not you're playing Superman, you're playing Batman. You're not impossibly better than the average man, you just have better equipment and are really, really good. And then he goes on to say, and you're not even really playing Batman, you're playing someone who aspires to be Batman. Like, at the end of the arc, when you get to that highest level, you will have become Batman.
Right, right. That's Matt Fitch's old school primer, that is a great way to play. That is a great way to play. I have some difference of opinions with Mr. Finch about that. But it's made a big impact. It's made people excited to play or old school, and that is that. All that is a good thing.
So, do you want to play those giant worlds, changing epic level events?
It's probably a bad idea. It's probably not a good idea. When I played the Q module, and destroy the demon goddess, and her plane of existence falls apart, and I tried to come back from that, my game was crap.
Hmm.
The game was totally horrible. And if I had been a fan reading what I was running after that, I would be totally outraged because it was a huge fart. after that.
I think it takes away probably some of the humanity of the characters you're playing, right? They become less relatable. So, I don't know.
I mean, you know, I've even playing BX, I mean, like, it's funny with this superhero analogy, because playing BX, you know, and getting to a high level, once the characters can all turn invisible and they can all fly and they can destroy undead at will, I was like, basically, they are superheroes. They fly into the situation visibly, undetectably, destroy everything. You basically are playing superheroes. And, you know, I don't even mind that that's at least a capacity of the system, even if you don't want to be playing at that level. It's like this, you should be aware that at high level it really does look like that.
I feel as though we are starting to range into a whole new topic, which maybe we should pocket for a future live cast.
I think you're right about that.
Okay, great. Do you have any final thoughts on intelligent weapons or intelligent swords?
So intelligent swords, if you're playing original D&D, every sword is intelligent. You should probably put some thought in advance into what powers you want to see in play. It's going to change your game as you switch from lower level to higher level. And you want to kind of, you probably do want to think carefully about exactly what abilities you want to have overwritten from more low-level characters. And then as far as the control rule works, you should definitely use Mr. Paul Siegel's excellent analysis and excellent simplification. That is what I do, and it saved me a heck of a lot of time my last convention.
My recommendation would be, regardless of what rules you're using, you can use mine if you like them, but you don't have to. But regardless of what control rules you're using, jot them down in a way that makes sense to you, somewhere that is going to be very easy for you to quickly access. Because that's always consistently my problem, even after I've boiled it down to a simple level, is it never seems to be at my fingertips when I need it. So write that down. As soon as your players find that intelligent sword, write those numbers down, put it somewhere, get ready, because it's coming.
Yeah, and have fun when it does.
Great. If you have any great stories of intelligent weapons, intelligent swords from your campaign, or how things may have gone awry, please post to our video here, post in the comments, or tell us what your general thoughts are on intelligent weapons or any of the stuff we've covered today. We'd love to hear from you.
We need more data. We haven't played with it enough. We need more data. Tell us what happened in your... yes, and so as always, please do subscribe to our YouTube channel at Wandering DMs. That always helps us out a lot. In 1 week, we're going to have the last Dan in Peru video. That'll be the end of that. After that, who knows who and where we will be talking about. 2 weeks from now, we'll have our next live discussion, so please come back and join the conversation in 2 Sundays from now at 1 p.m., for another thought-provoking discussion, and we will talk to you next time.
See you then.